Welcome back to Shattering Myths. As we left the last segment, we're having a conversation with Glenn about why it is that the celebration by Hamas and the PLO of the kidnapping of the three Israeli boys was made available through mainline news sources immediately after the kidnapping. And the ongoing even discussion about how Hamas was condemning the PLO and Abbas for speaking out against the kidnapping when Hamas was celebrating them. And then the thing that changed was, the thing that really made me angry, was that in subsequent news stories from the exact same news sources, New York Times, International Herald, CNN, Reuters, the BBC, they would have a statement in there and they say that, you know, Israel blames Hamas for the kidnappings, a claim that that Hamas denies. And they'd leave it at that. When they themselves had published stories and they knew for a fact that Hamas had celebrated these kidnappings, that Hamas called the kidnappers great heroes. And then to not include that information in subsequent reportings tells you a great deal about the lack of character, the lack of integrity, and the even conspiratorial nature, the ingrained hatred of Israel by news reporting agencies like the Washington Post, CNN, the BBC. I think that's the point that you were making, Glenn, is that, you know, why is it that they would report information and just ever so briefly and then cover the story and omit crucial information from the story?
Right.
What are we to make of that?
It's a conspiracy, but it's obviously not a Jewish one, apparently.
No, as a matter of fact, I would agree with you there. There are lots of conspiracies that are very real, and the ones that are blamed on Jews almost never are. But the like the protocols of the Elders of Zion, you know, it's one of the most thoroughly disgraced myths of all time. And yet it is used to substantiate conspiracies against Jews, even today. I mean, it was used...
Hello, this is Glenn from Philadelphia speaking. We're just waiting for the connection for Yada to be restored. I'll just go ahead and continue on with the comment, my next comment I was going to make to Yada, which is, you know, it just doesn't seem... the character of terrorists just doesn't seem to be today what it used to be. Back in my day, in the 70s and 80s, when I was growing up as a young adult, you know, when a terrorist committed a gruesome, horrible, you know, despicable, grisly murder, he had the guts to stand up and take credit for it. Even they, you know, wanted to take credit for it. But nowadays, it seems that everybody wants to maintain plausible deniability by alleging the possibility of a false flag attack. And this muddies the waters horrifically. If every time a horrible crime, or whether you wish to view these recent murders in Israel as crimes or acts of terrorism, if when every time something like that happens, you know, the one side who would most probably be accused of it presumes to allege that it is really a false flag attack by the other guys to make them look bad, the general hearers, anyone listening or trying to puzzle this out or figure out what really happened, really has no way of knowing what went on. And, you know, when you think in terms of the idea that truth is the first casualty of war, and that when people are warring and they're willing to lie and dissemble, and want confusion to reign, then this is what we have today. We end up with everybody pointing fingers at the other and blaming them for not only being violent, but also for being liars and willing to attack their own resources, their own people, and for the sake of blaming someone else. And, you know, this just makes for a morally reprehensible situation that people from other people groups or other countries don't know how to understand and can't make any can't come to any reasonable or authoritative conclusions about who's responsible for what. Everything again is yada tout so often. If you're going to investigate, we have to wait for authorities to investigate and come up with use reason and evidence to point to, wait for something more authoritative to come out that says, aha, now we have you dead to rights, and here's the evidence. If people aren't going to take responsibility for and claim their actions, as terrorists pretty much used to do during most of my lifetime, now everything becomes a matter of proving. It's almost like a murder mystery on TV where, you know, people may rightly think that a certain person did it, or there's a surprise ending where we find out that someone else had done the murder, and we wait for the clever detective, the very patient and careful detectives to come up with that, those pieces of evidence that, you know, manifest to everyone who is truly at fault. And this is what we have now in all these situations. When we have governments willing to lie, terrorist organizations, dissent organizations of dissent, everybody's willing to lie. We don't know who to trust. And then, of course, at this point, I can just, you know, certainly picture God affirming, we know that we can trust Yahweh, and we know that we can, you know, trust his word as a standard. And Yada speaks of this all the time when he talks about comparing Paul to the Torah, Song of Prophets, and Psalms. And, you know, when we see these contradictions, it's a very hard thing. And Yahweh was very stringent, you know, when what Christians would tend to call the Old Testament times, or in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, the criteria for, whether or not someone was a true prophet were very stringent. And if someone wasn't telling the truth, then actually the prescription was for him to be stoned. So, and we know that God cannot lie. Yahweh does not lie. And yet we, you know, humans, in human institutions, leaders of human institutions and dissenting groups lie all the time. And many times we can't know, what's going on halfway around the world with two or three or four different groups accusing, counter-accusing, and lying about the facts. But we know that we can trust, Yahweh. And just rely on his word. We know that all of these things are going to go in a certain direction. God has given us it's never been an immediate timetable. He has given us certain events to watch for. We know that the Magog war is going to happen. We see the table of nations mentioned in there, all these different nations, going to be involved in coming up against Israel in the last days, and we're moving inextricably in that direction. We know that, you know, Persia, modern Iran, is going to be involved. We know that Ethiopia and Assyria, we know various nations are all mentioned. Rosh, and we know that there are people groups coming down out of what is areas of modern Russia, you know, Rosh and Tobolsk and that sort of thing being mentioned. We don't know exactly what form it's going to take politically in our modern terms, but we know these regions and these people groups are going to be involved, and certainly it seems that Islam is going to play a huge role in this, and we're seeing this, the positioning of the players if you will, on the chessboard or on the risk board for those who played the game called Risk. Maybe in the 70s, those of you old enough to remember when the game Risk was very popular, a game of world domination, and you get three or four people sitting down trying to roll dice and move little pieces on the board and take over the world. Well, that's very much how the modern globalists, you know, they war game their scenarios out, and they pit entity against entity for the sake of gaining various, you know, short-term goals on the way to achieving their longer-term goals. But Yahweh is transcendent of space and time. He can, he sees all time at all through at all times, and he has given us his word in advance to know what's going to come down.
Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We have a guest that's joined us, and is Robert Cristiano, a former Christian who made the jump to Yahweh's family, which is easy enough to do. How are you doing today, Bob?
I am well. I am quite well. Thank you for asking.
Well, you ought to be. You run a wellness center. You better be, right?
That's right. Well, thanks for joining us, Bob. Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Bob, you know, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Let's see. Born and raised Baptist for 50 years. Just caught up into that whole thing and never knew there was any options. Yeah, I didn't know God had a name. I didn't know anything about the covenant and the feast. I mean, nothing at all for 50 years. And, yeah, then one day I was exposed to the name and, you know, started digging in. Because I always felt that there was, I was missing something. You know, that quote unquote God's got to be bigger than this New Testament. I mean, and I can't speak for other religions, but being a Baptist, that's all you were taught was New Testament. We're New Testament believers. And I got old after a while. I hate to say it, hate to put it that way, but it got old after a while.
Well, and it doesn't make sense because, I mean, I think most people are aware there's something woefully wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at the churches, I think they know that. You know, we know that the covenant has not been restored because Yahweh tells us very clearly that when he restores the covenant, he is going to literally incorporate the Torah as part of our being.
Exactly.
You know, that's how out of vogue it is to him. I mean, his plan was always the Torah, and Yahusha was fulfilling Torah when he fulfilled the Moed Mikra, when he was crucified, when his soul went to Sheol and served as a ransom, and when he rose for Bikurim, or first fruits. You know, that is all Torah.
Right.
And, you know, apparently the rabbis couldn't find the mercy in the Torah. And of course, you know, when they invented their new religion, when Marcion decided that Yahweh's words were out of vogue or Old Testament when he threw it aside, I guess he decided just to plaster over the Moed Mikra, and then, you know, Constantine comes along and removes the upright pole for a satanic cross.
Sure.
And then,
sure,
of course, as you mentioned earlier, you didn't even know God had a name.
Right.
So I'm sure you were calling him by Satan's title or Baal's title, Lord.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, which is frightening to say the least. You know, and you're talking about the new covenant and Yahshua there. It just goes to show the copy edit errors because, you know, like in the King James and stuff, it'll say, you know, I will make a new covenant. When in reality, as we know, I will renew my covenant. So just one word sends us off on a totally different mindset, a totally different trail.
Yeah, and of course they don't read beyond that where he says when he's renewing his covenant, it's the Torah is going to be incorporated in everybody. Today you have to study it. You don't know it. You have to read it.
That's right.
You know, and I don't know what percentage of the Torah we can even observe or understand. But as long as we're observing and our eyes and ears are opening, which is what Yahweh asks us to do, he doesn't expect a lot out of us, you know, but he expects us to take his words seriously.
Sure, and you know, when I first became one of Yah's children, you know, I used to say, you know, shame on these pastors and preachers for, you know, teaching falsehood. And but now it's like, shame on the people. You know, pardon me?
Yeah. It's both.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you're required to dig in and so on and so forth. Don't put the whole onus on the pastor. I mean, you know, that just tells me you're really not serious. You know, you're really not serious. I mean, crying out loud, I mean, our eternal destiny is at stake here. You know, wouldn't one, if one was truly serious, wouldn't one want to turn over every rock just to make sure you're getting the truth?
If they believed it. If they truly believed it.
Yeah.
I don't think most people do. I think it's a lot of lip service.
I agree.
Welcome back to Saturday, Miss. We had a technical glitch in that last, really, 2 seconds. One of the challenges of doing a program like this is most everyone broadcasts remotely. We all use voice over internet protocol to broadcast. So we are all in our own private studios, no matter what show is being broadcast, really on virtually any radio network. And the show is fed via the internet using broadband via these units called Comrex units that are able to buffer and transmit voice in reasonably high fidelity using fairly expensive equipment, which is then brought together again in the syndicator studio and then uplinked to satellites and also stored on their computers for archive use and presented in live streaming in a number of other ways. And that process typically works fairly seamlessly, but of course, occasionally the backbone for the internet goes down in one community or another, or if you have power outages, you have issues. But the challenge really is for the host, particularly if you're doing this, as most of us do, you know, looking at a computer screen and speaking into a microphone with a headset on. You might notice, hey, you know, it's awful quiet out there, but you're just continuing to add content to the best of your ability. You're wondering, gee, you know, I was just asked this case we had Glenn on. I asked Glenn a question. My switchboard is working fine, but there's no Glenn to comment. And I'm going on and on about a story, and we go right through a known time for commercial break, but there's no contact. And that's what happened. Aaron, who produces the show, tried to reach me, but I ignored the phone so that I could continue to deliver program content. And I understand that Glenn did a marvelous job of concluding the segment where I was disconnected, and that we played an archived segment in the short 6-minute segment preceding this, and that we are back live. Now, one of the challenges at this point is I was covering a story that I think is of significant importance, and how much of that story was effectively broadcast before the backbone somewhere between here, the internet, somewhere between my studio and the GCN went kaput, and we disconnected. I don't know where I was in that story. So I'm going to go back to the beginning of this next story, knowing that I could be repeating myself. But I apologize, and we will commence forward from here. But that is what happened in the last segment. And thank you, Glenn, for covering during the previous segment. This is first report is from Reuters. The leader of the Islamic State, and they say in Iraq and Levant, and what I shared previously is that it has never been the Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant. It has always been the Islamic State, and then it was the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria when they moved across the border with guns that Americans had provided to Sunnis in the Awakening program in Iraq and began the initial proxy war against the Syrian government. The war against the Syrian government was staged initially by the Islamic State in Iraq because they were armed with American weapons. And in Syria, the average citizens did not have weapons. It was a dictatorial state. In dictatorial states, dictators don't allow civilians to be armed. That's why you should be really concerned if you're an American and you're a proponent of arms control legislation, gun control legislation. It suits dictators to have the public unarmed. And so for that political protest several years ago to turn to a civil war, it required the other side to have weapons, and the first weapons that were deployed by the Islamic State in Iraq because America had given them weapons in the Awakening program. That was Petraeus's, what he called a great success, which was celebrated as a great success in America, while all the time I was telling America, no, this is going to backfire. This is a horrible move because of what will be done with those weapons. And that's what happened. When the Islamic State in Iraq moved into Syria, they became the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. And the word that they used for Syria is from the Hebrew term for Syria. And it speaks of Greater Syria during the 5th, 6th, 7th century BCE, almost 3,000 years ago. And that Syria speaks of Assyria. And Sham is the Arabic word in this case. And so there, the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria was really all of modern-day Iran, all of modern-day Iraq, all of modern-day Syria, all of modern-day Lebanon, and all of modern-day Jordan would be collectively part of Assyria. Now, Assyria was never Israel, and Levant includes Israel. So there is it's completely inappropriate. It's used erroneously here. I think, as it's been mentioned, the reason that it's being used is that if you put in a Levant, because both people know and associate Levant with Israel, that this is a group claiming control over Israel. But that's not what Sham, Syria, means. That's not what the Arabic word conveys. It's not what the Hebrew word that the Arabic word is based on conveys. Now, this first report from Reuters has the leader of the Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant, of which there is no longer an Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, much less an Islamic State in Iraq and Levant, being Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. But fact is, that was never his name. It was really a title for the man named Ibrahim. And Ibrahim is now declaring himself the caliph of the Islamic world because he is head of the Islamic State, and he is establishing and telling the world that this region that he controls between all of northern and eastern Syria and all of western Iraq is the Islamic State. And he is the head of that state. And he's also, by changing the name to the Islamic State and calling himself the caliph of the Islamic State, that he sees its present territory as being a mere shadow of what it will ultimately grow to become. He is announcing that he wishes, by using this term, to go beyond even what the Ottoman Empire once was. And the Ottoman Empire controlled vast swaths of territory throughout the Islamic world. And the last time that the Ottoman Empire was in control, they had a caliph that claimed to be the supreme leader of all Muslims. He is now reestablishing that, but not as the Ottoman Empire, as pure and unabridged Islam. So this is the difference between the two and what it is inspiring. He is actually now asking Muslims to immigrate into the Islamic State. Then CNN has a story on the same story. Their story is much longer, and we have just begun to cover it, I think, when we lost contact. But in it, it begins in a bold declaration of its ambition, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, and it's no longer that. So this is a story on what it has become. You ought to use its name correctly. The Islamic State has laid down the claim to leadership of a global Islamic movement, calling on Muslims worldwide to swear allegiance to its leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. That's not what they're asking. They're asking them to swear allegiance to its leader, Caliph Ibrahim. That's the man's real name. By claiming such preeminence, then they go back to ISIS. But it's not ISIS, it's IS now, if you want to use an acronym. It's the Islamic State. Is going to eclipse al-Qaeda and its leader, Ayman al-Zawahiri. And this is where, in the portion of the program, I think, that was not properly broadcast and therefore connected, but I wanted to make a extraordinarily important proclamation for people to think about. At the peak of its power, which would have been during the time that al-Qaeda was getting its start, where it was from a size point of view, it was a pimple on a camel's behind. The camel at the time was the Pakistani Taliban. Al-Qaeda was just simply a pimple along for the ride as part of an agency of, if you will, the Pakistani Taliban. Was deployed, was rented from Pakistan by the American Congress using the CIA. And the CIA provided some, and the Carter administration, some $5 billion worth of weaponry to the Pakistani Taliban, of which al-Qaeda was used to recruit out-of-territory jihadists, additional jihadists from places like Libya and Egypt, and really throughout the world, America, Europe, Africa. And that was al-Qaeda's function as part of this alliance between the American administration, the Carter administration, and the CIA and the Pakistani Taliban. And that, at the conclusion of that great jihad against the Soviet-backed government, where the Taliban and American military might collectively brought down the Soviet-backed government, that was the height of al-Qaeda's power. Now, we'll compare that to what ISIS is now after the commercial break. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're talking about the difference now between what ISIS, which is now the Islamic State, has become and is at this very moment, and what al-Qaeda was at its height. And this is an extremely important thing for us to grapple with, because so much of the fight against terrorism is blamed on al-Qaeda, and the current deployment is blamed on al-Qaeda, and the Islamic State in Syria, Iraq and Syria, has been associated with al-Qaeda. All myths. Al-Qaeda at the peak of its height was not really even one of those that had access to the $5 billion worth of weaponry that America provided the Pakistani Taliban. They were a recruiting aspect for the jihad. That's why they were called the base by the CIA. It was the database of potential fundamentalist Muslims that could be recruited from other countries to come fight alongside the Pakistani Taliban using American weapons to fight off the Soviet-backed government of Afghanistan. And America's purpose, according to Zbigniew Brzezinski, was to give the Russians, the Soviets at the time, a taste of what they gave the Americans in Vietnam, that it was, to some degree, Soviet weaponry that was wielded by the North Vietnamese against the Americans when America invaded Vietnam. And so since the Soviets controlled most all of the regions throughout the Caspian Sea and also the Caucasus Mountains and went down now into Afghanistan controlling that government, America wanted to give them a taste of the Vietnam and therefore to arm those who would wield those arms in a proxy fashion to torment them. And so the height of al-Qaeda's power was as a subsidiary, if you will, a recruiting arm for the Taliban, which was wielding American weapons when the Soviet-backed government of Afghanistan fell. At that time, al-Qaeda had a few million dollars in cash reserves, maybe even 10 or 20 million in cash reserves. At that time, al-Qaeda had some weapons, but de minimis. At that time, al-Qaeda had the names of jihadists and may have had as many as 5,000 jihadists that it had recruited from various places around the world. But it had no territory. The territory that had been taken from the Soviet-backed government of Afghanistan was claimed by the Taliban, not by al-Qaeda. That was al-Qaeda at its most dominant point. Now, let's compare that to the Islamic State. The Islamic State has a net worth in the somewhere in the range of $1.5 to $2 billion versus the high water mark for al-Qaeda was probably $10 million. This is $1.5 billion to $2 billion with their wealth growing exponentially. Second, the Islamic State has probably in the range now of those fighting on its behalf between the Sunnis who have leagued with it in Iraq because of the oppression of the Sunnis against the Shia against the Sunnis. You know, it has several million now Sunni Arabs who have joined in the cause to repulse the Shia, their Shia overlords in Iraq. And they have tens of thousands of jihadis fighting on their behalf in Syria. And with their continued successes, they're gaining adherence at an amazing rate to the point where it will be in the many millions, vastly overshadowing al-Qaeda at its prime. At its prime, al-Qaeda has some surface-to-air missiles, mostly rocket-propelled grenades, that it was wielding, its jihadists were wielding against Soviet aircraft, mostly helicopters. Well, at this point, the Islamic State has captured billions of dollars worth of America's military equipment that was given to the Sunni, the Shiite government in Iraq. And so it is hugely more powerful. And it controls vast swaths of land. It is 1,000 times more popular, folks.